Before we start pulling on the thread, the long thread of Balaam, all right, I have some questions for some of the young folks. So if you may answer this if you are under the age of 30. Okay? I mean, that's Chip and Jonathan and Michael and Leah. All right? Okay. A little historical note before we jump into things. If you were to hear the term the apostolic fathers, who is this referring to?
The apostles.
Nope.
Paul.
Good guess. What's that?
Paul.
No. This is a catch-all term, and this is a somewhat modern term. This is a catch-all term for
the fathers of the apostles.
That is a great guess, and also incorrect. This is the catch-all term for the second generation of Christian leaders, okay? The apostolic fathers. There's a collection of writings called the Writings of the Apostolic Fathers. And so this will range from like potentially the 60s AD. So generation doesn't mean all the apostles are dead, but just they weren't the apostles. They were the ones who were taught by the apostles or associates of the apostles. So this could range anywhere from like 60 AD potentially to like the middle of the second century, which is probably when the thing I'm about to read to you comes from. All right. So apostolic fathers, this is the second generation of leadership. So like there's a letter from a person in Rome named Clement. All right, first and second Clement. There is a supposed letter from Barnabas in this group. Barnabas, who was one of the companions of the apostles. Nobody these days thinks it was actually Barnabas, but it was written in this time period. Or the Didache, which as a group we've discussed before, which is like an early catechism, an early teaching book about Christian doctrine. What I'm going to read a selection from you for you today is from a book called The Martyrdom of Polycarp. Okay. Martyrdom, once again, young people, means what? You can be a martyr if? Right, that's right. So martyrdom of Polycarp. Now, what do you guys know about the name Polycarp?
Penta
means five. Poly just means many. I actually don't know what carp means in this case. That's a fantastic guess. Polycarp was a disciple of John. So, this guy, all right, because the Apostle John lived into this, potentially into the second century, barely. He lived very old age. All the other apostles were killed, but John lived for a very old age. Polycarp was a disciple, historically speaking, of John. Okay? So he would have actually been able to talk to apostles. So the martyrdom of Polycarp is about Polycarp's martyrdom. So I'm going to read a little bit of this in just a second. But first, turn to Revelation if you're not already there. Now, Polycarp was a bishop, meaning a leader of the church. He was a bishop in Smyrna. So let's read the letter to Smyrna in Revelation. This would be Revelation chapter 2. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write the words of the first and the last who died and came to life, which of course is a reference to Jesus. I know your tribulation, your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. Now, as we've discussed, these letters all end with some statement about those who conquer. In this particular case, what does the crown of life mean? Everlasting life, eternal life, right? Because they were already alive, so it must obviously be talking about something else. It's talking about resurrection. It's talking about not being a part of the second death. It means eternal life. Okay. So Polycarp, quite a bit after Revelation, all right, Polycarp was arrested. And when the story takes place, he is, at this point in the story, in the arena. Okay? He's in the arena. And they have brought Polycarp out into the arena, and someone is talking to him. So if I, this is in the Martyrdom of Polycarp, section 9. You should totally read it. It's got some fantastic and or potentially not fantastic, not in the sense of great, but fantastic in the sense of mythical elements to it, perhaps. But Polycarp is in the stadium, and the proconsul is talking to him and says this: "Have respect for your age and other things, as they are accustomed to say. Swear by the genius of Caesar. Repent, say away with the atheists." So the proconsul is talking to Polycarp and trying to get him to say, okay, I won't be a Christian. Or, at the very least, say, yes, I swear by the genius of Caesar. Now, when we think of genius, what do we think? Old people can also answer at this point. Intelligence, right? That's not quite what they meant. They meant like a spirit, all right? And so if we think about maybe the Smyrnans in the first century, when you have the imperial cult, the cult around worshiping Caesar, all right? When they talk about this here in Polycarp's time, this would be generally applicable, maybe not quite the same words all the time, but generally applicable back then. And they would say, swear by the genius of Caesar. Swear by the spirit of Caesar. Because, like Augustus, for example, said he was the son of a god. All right? Not in the sense of a monotheistic god relationship, but the son of the deified Julius Caesar is what Augustus would call himself. And so when this proconsul says to Polycarp, or would have said to the Smyrnans in the first century, swear by the genius or spirit of Caesar, what they were essentially trying to do is say, recognize who Caesar is, right? Recognize his exaltation and his divinity, all right? So what is Polycarp's answer to this? Oh, and he also says, away with, he wants Polycarp to say, away with the atheist, all right? And so when the Romans are talking to the Christians and calling them atheist, what do you think they mean? Not that they don't believe in a god, because obviously Christians do. They don't believe that Caesar's in any way divine, and they don't believe in the rest of the gods, right? They don't believe in Jupiter. They don't believe in Minerva, all right? Various different beings. So this proconsul's telling Polycarp, say, away with the atheists. And so what Polycarp does at this point, right, and of course, when the proconsul's talking, he's talking about Christians. And Polycarp solemnly looked at the whole crowd of lawless heathen who were in the stadium, mentioned toward them with his hand. So he points to all the Romans and says, away with the atheists, right? So Polycarp's like, I'm not the atheist, you're the atheist, because you don't recognize the true God. And so, when the magistrate persisted and said, swear the oath and I will release you, revile Christ, Polycarp replied, for 86 years I have been his servant, and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme the king who saved me? And so it goes on, he keeps trying to get him to give up. Polycarp won't. So he dies. He's killed with a dagger. So in the end, and this is why where I'm going with this, in the end, when he's martyred, all right, the Christians want his body back. All right? Christians want to take care of his body. Reasonable thing. But the jealous and envious evil one, the adversary of the race of the righteous, when he observed the greatness of Polycarp's martyrdom and irreproachable character of his life from the beginning, and realized that he was now crowned with the crown of immortality and had won a prize that no one could challenge, saw to it that not even his poor body should be taken away by us, even though many desired to do this and to touch his holy flesh. So note this is what I thought was really interesting. when it says here, and so this is the commentator, this is the person writing the story talking about this, and when he talks about Polycarp, he says that, realize that he has now crowned with the crown of immortality. You know what? I don't think it's coincidence that the writer of the Martyrdom of Polycarp is using the exact same terminology, all right, as the letter that John wrote to the Smyrnans, right? Because if you look, there's all sorts of things you could say. You could say all sorts of things about somebody when they die. But whoever wrote this said he made it, right? He was crowned with the crown of life, immortality. I don't think that's coincidence. Yeah.
Do you think that's his inspired way of saying it, or do you think that was a common lingo among them at the time?
I bet. Here's what I bet. All right. Think of yourself as a member of the early church, and if you had a letter from an apostle to you, all right.
So they would read this.
Yeah. Yeah, the Smyrnans should have gotten this letter, right? And so what are they going to think? Well, you know what? I want to get that crown of life. That was the letter actually written to them. So when somebody's writing the account of Polycarp, sure, it could be coincidence that he uses that terminology. I don't think so. I think it's like, no, Polycarp made it, right? He was one of those guys who went through the persecution unto the end, and he got what was promised in the letter to the Smyrnans. Interesting historical factoid. We don't call the Martyrdom of Polycarp inspired, but it is inspiring. You should read it. It'd be worth it. Okay, let's jump in to Balaam here in just a second. First, if you look in Revelation chapter 2, all right, verse 14, do you have a Bible that has notes? That just has Bible references? Okay. What are some of the things that it references? Uh-huh. Okay.
Jude 11.
Okay.
Acts
15:29. Okay. 1 Corinthians 8:10. What else?
Numbers
31:16. Is it reference Numbers 25?
Yeah,
25. All right.
1 Corinthians 6:13.
So if you've got a Bible with notes, sometimes they can point you to lots of really interesting material. We're going to hit probably most of these this morning as we talk about Balaam. Okay. Now, you were supposed to go read about Balaam. Did anybody, for example, look up 2 Peter or Jude or Numbers 31? Okay, let's go to Numbers. Balaam seems to be a bad guy in Revelation chapter 2. Not seems. It's quite clearly a bad guy there. Now, if we go to Numbers, Genesis, Leviticus, Numbers 25. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, sorry. I have read the Old Testament before, I promise. All right, so if we go to Numbers, all right? Numbers 25, all right? Let's back up a little bit. Numbers 22. All right, so here's the scenario, okay? The Israelites have just defeated a number of peoples, all right? And in chapter 22, the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains beyond Moab. If this group of people have just defeated some other nations, and they are in the plains right outside of Moab, what are the Moabites going to think? Yay or bad, right? They're going to think bad. These people might just take us out. So, Balak, the king, calls to a man named Balaam. Now, he is apparently some sort of priest, spiritual figure. All right, so Balak calls Balaam and says, hey, I need you to go curse the Israelites. And now Balaam has a vision from God, all right, and says, nope, I'm not going to do that. So Balak sends messengers to Balaam, and Balaam says, no, I'm not coming with you. I'm not going to curse the Israelites. And then Balak, insisting, says, nope, I'm going to send more people. I really want Balaam. So he sends more people, more impressive princes, to go visit Balaam and to say, hey, I need you to come curse the Israelites. And so Balaam at first is resistant, but God tells Balaam to go. Now at this point, we're probably thinking sympathetically towards Balaam. Balak, bad guy. Balaam, good guy. And if you read through 24, you're often going to get a positive view of Balaam, if that's all you read. Balaam's, he seems to be doing what God asked him to do. Not all is rosy, though, because God almost kills him, all right? But he seems to be pretty good. The way we're supposed to read this story, though, all right, and this is going to be very clear when we get to Numbers 31, we are not supposed to view Balaam as a sympathetic figure. Okay? Probably the only sympathetic figure in this whole story is the donkey, right? Because the donkey does nothing wrong and is beaten by Balaam. All right? So just think of that he is the only sympathetic character, even though we might not know why at this point in the story. So Balaam goes along, and then you've got the story of Balaam on the donkey. Now God says, go, all right? I want you to go. But at the same time, it also says here in 22, God's anger was kindled because he went. All right? How exactly does that work? I'm not sure. But it is what it is. So Balaam is on the donkey. And the story, several times, right, three times. Balaam's going along, riding on the donkey. And this is a donkey that Balaam's had all his life, apparently. Or at least all the donkey's life. Balaam has ridden this donkey, all right? And so they're walking along, and God puts an angel in front of Balaam. And the donkey can see the angel, but Balaam can't see the angel. Now the donkey, when he sees the angel, turns aside, all right? Balaam gets mad, all right? Naturally, because you don't know what's going on, and your donkey, you're going down the road, and suddenly, boom, you're off in a field. So you're mad. So now he's going to go into a vineyard, all right? And the angel's standing at the edge of the vineyard, and the donkey sees the angel, and the donkey turns and rubs Balaam's leg against a wall. It hurts Balaam, so Balaam's really angry and beats the donkey. But the donkey once again is saving Balaam's life. Okay. Next, he goes again. They come to a narrow place. There's an angel there. The donkey just lays on the ground because he can't go around the angel in this case, and he's certainly not going to walk forward. Because there's an angel there with a sword waiting to kill Balaam. And so Balaam strikes the donkey. And so you've got there in verse 27. This is Numbers 22, verse 27. When the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh, she lay down under Balaam. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he struck the donkey with his staff. Then Yahweh opened the mouth of the donkey. And she said to Balaam, what have I done to you that you have struck me these three times? And Balaam said to the donkey, because you have made a fool of me. I wish I had a sword in my hand, for then I would kill you. All right. Then the donkey said to Balaam, am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life long to this day? Is it my habit to treat you this way? And he said, no. Then Yahweh opened the eyes of Balaam. And he saw the angel of Yahweh standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed down and fell on his face. And the angel of the Lord said to him, why have you struck your donkey these three times? All right, so that's why the donkey is the only one who doesn't do anything wrong in any of this. Even the Israelites are not sympathetic in this story, as we'll see in just a second. So the story goes on. Balak says, okay, Balaam, I need you to curse the Israelites. So in chapter 23, the first part, he, instead of cursing the Israelites, he blesses them because he feels like he has to, right? Because God does not want him to curse the Israelites. And once again, we might start thinking, well, okay, Balaam's a good guy. He's actually not. Balaam's second oracle, all right? So Balak asked him again, well, maybe if you go over here, then you'll be able to curse them. And he can't, once again, curse them. Chapter 24, you got two more oracles, same situation. Balak wants Balaam to curse the Israelites, and he can't. All right, he can only bless the Israelites. And so you got the last verse in chapter 24. Then Balaam rose and went back to his place, and Balak also went his way. Okay? You have to read the next chapter with that story. Super important. And we'll see why in just a second. While Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab, right? Balak, king of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel yoked himself to Baal at Peor. And the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel. And Yahweh said to Moses, "Take all the chiefs of the people and hang them in the sun before Yahweh, that the fierce anger of Yahweh may turn away from Israel." And Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you kill those of his men who have yoked themselves to Baal at Peor." And behold, one of the people of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman to his family in the sight of Moses and in the sight of the whole congregation of the people of Israel, while they were weeping in the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose and left the congregation and took a spear in his hand and went after the man of Israel into the chamber and pierced both of them, the man of Israel and the woman, through her belly. Thus the plague on the people of Israel was stopped. Nevertheless, those who died by the plague were 24,000. Balak's bad, Balaam ambiguous at this point, Israel bad. All right? Israel still the people of God, so they don't get wiped out. And also partially because of Phinehas, right? Phinehas the hero. Phinehas, the one full of zeal, stops the anger of God by punishing the sin. Okay? Now turn to Numbers 31. All right. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Avenge the people of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people." So Moses spoke to the people, saying, "Arm men from among you for the war, that they may go against Midian to execute Yahweh's vengeance on Midian. So you shall send 1,000 from each of the tribes of Israel to the war." So they were provided out of the thousands of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. And Moses sent them to the war, 1,000 from each tribe, together with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, with the vessels of the sanctuary and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. They warred against Midian as Yahweh commanded Moses, and killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of the slain, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian, and they also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. And the people of Israel took captive the women of Midian and their little ones, and they took as plunder all their cattle, their flocks, and all their goods, all their cities, and the places where they lived, and all their encampments. They burned with fire, and took all the spoil of all the plunder, both of man and beast, and then brought the captives and the plunder and the spoil to Moses and to Eleazar the priest, and to the congregation of the people of Israel at the camp on the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the chiefs of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. And Moses was angry with the officers of the army, commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds who had come from service in the war. Moses said to them, "Have you let all the women live? Behold, these, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against Yahweh in the incident of Peor. And so the plague came among the congregations of Yahweh. Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones and every woman who has known man by lying with him. But all the young girls who have not known man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. And camp outside the camp 7 days. Whoever of you has killed any person, whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves and your captives on the third day and on the seventh day. You shall purify every garment, every article of skin, all works of goat's hair, and every article of wood." Why is Balaam guilty? Why did he need to die? Despite the earlier story, what does this tell us that we didn't know before about Balaam?
He was with the Midianites.
that he was with the Midianites, and the plot to have the women come into the camp of the Israelites to lead them astray was Balaam's idea. Okay? That's what it says here in 16. Behold, these, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against Yahweh in the incident of Peor. So in other words, when Balaam went home, it was also on his instruction that said, if you want to get to the Israelites, here's what you do. Send your women. All right? Send your women over there to the Israelites. Now, how successful was Balaam's plan?
Pretty successful, until Phinehas.
Pretty good. I mean, you could look at it one way and say he almost got him, right? Because it worked for a while, and God was very angry at the Israelites for falling for this, right? They should have known better. They had the law. They should not have done this. But they did, all right? And it was because of Phinehas, all right? Also because of Moses and others, but especially because of Phinehas, right? That Israel as a nation was saved, all right? So you can genericize this into a general lesson, which we've talked about many times. I often go to Solomon, right? To Solomon and his wives, you know, the instruction to Solomon, don't take many wives because they will lead you away from the Lord your God, which did happen. This story, all right, is another good example of this, where the wicked say, all right, we need to lead these men astray. What are we going to do? Let's send the women, all right? And what's going to happen? It's not just, in the case of many, it's not just sex, ultimately. It's also intermarriage, it's disobedience against God. It's going to be, ultimately, worshiping their idols. All right? That's where all of this leads. So that's Balaam. All right? So if you just read the first chapters about Balaam, you'd be tempted to take him as a sympathetic character. But God does not, all right? Moses does not, because they look at Balaam and say it was his advice to do this. All right? Now, let's turn to the New Testament. Now, the reason why we went over those verses that the Bible translations often have. This is why it's good to pay attention to those verses. If we turn to 2 Peter. Second Peter 2:15. All right. Talking about bad things, all right? If we start at 14, they have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. They entice unsteady souls. They have hearts trained in greed. Accursed children, forsaking the right way, they have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved gain from wrongdoing, but was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with human voice and restrained the prophet's madness. All right, turn to Jude. Alright, Jude, we'll start in verse 10. But these people blaspheme all that they do not understand, and they are destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively. Woe to them, for they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error and perished in Korah's rebellion. Okay? A mention of Balaam there. So you've got these two mentions of Balaam, one in 2 Peter, one in Jude. You've, of course, got it here in Revelation, which is why we were mentioning it. Let's go ahead and, since we're in the middle of that, let's go ahead and read it one more time. Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2, verse 14. But I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel so that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice sexual immorality. Okay? The author of Revelation, all right, that was not the first time that we hear that Balaam is the cause of all this. That's back in Numbers. And so this is not new for John. He's just reading the whole thing and going, all of that was Balaam's fault, and you've got somebody in your church that's like Balaam. All right? He's compromising. Now, let's jump around again. Acts 15. And then I'll stop making you jump around. Acts 15 is the account of the so-called Jerusalem Council. All right? There is a question. There was a question, how should the Gentiles behave? Do the Gentiles need to obey all of the Mosaic law? And ultimately, the Jerusalem Council said no. They don't have to obey all of the law. So if you look at Acts 15, verse 19, therefore, my judgment is that we should not trouble those of the Gentiles who turn to God, but should write to them to abstain from some basic things. Abstain from the things polluted by idols, probably food sacrificed to idols, right? And from sexual immorality, and from what has been strangled, and from blood. For from ancient generations, Moses had had in every city those who proclaim him, for he has read every Sabbath in the synagogues. All right? Now, this last part is about there's Jews all over the place. We don't want to offend them too much. Here's some basics. And notice, he goes for the basics of Balaam's error. All right? Plus a few other things. All right? Don't eat things stained by idols and sexual immorality. Now, when we were discussing Revelation the other day, last week, right, could this be just spiritual sexual immorality? Because often that is the case. We'll talk about sexual immorality as a metaphor for spiritual abandonment, of apostasy from God. Is that what's going on in the city of Pergamum? Maybe, right? If we think about Polycarp and Pergamum as would have been a place where the cult of Caesar would have been going on, and people would absolutely want them to sacrifice to the genius of Caesar. Could it be spiritual adultery? Absolutely. And not physical adultery or physical fornication, any sort of sexual immorality in any way. Absolutely. Okay? But all right, especially for this is for everyone, but especially for those of you who are not married. All right, sex outside of marriage, all right, is always going to lead you into idolatry. Period. All right, it may not be obvious idolatry in the sense of I'm going to worship this little idol. Okay, it always leads you away from God. Period. There is no such thing as sex outside of marriage, all right, which applies to married people as well. There's no such thing as sex outside of marriage that does not lead you to away from God. All right? There's no such thing as just casual sex. It is all apostasy, every bit of it. Okay? Because it's always going to lead you morally away from God. All right, for those of you who have not yet gone to college, your greatest temptation. All right, and I'm not going to pretend to understand how women think, but I can understand how men think. All right, your greatest problem in this world, all right, morally, is to keep yourself sexually pure. Okay, because a woman will lead you away from God. Now, this can also happen to women too. Like I said, I'm not going to pretend to know what goes on in their heads. All right? But same thing applies to you. All right? Getting with the wrong man will absolutely lead you away from God. What does the proverb say about the person who commits sexual immorality? What are they? They are the fool. All right? Always the fool. So, I mention all of this in Revelation, because it could be spiritual adultery. You know what? I'm not sure they're ever really separated. All right? I mean, they can theoretically be. But it is, man is by nature sexual. All right? And these will overlap a whole lot. All right? So if we might want to talk about this as a metaphor for spiritual abandonment of God, okay, that's possible. But that other element there is not going to be far behind, chances are. Okay? So that's Balaam's error. So who should we look to if we want a good example of this whole problem of the interplay between sexual immorality and apostasy? Solomon is still a good example. But Peter, Jude, John, all of them explicitly go back to Balaam as a good example of that. Was that exactly what James and Peter at the Jerusalem Council were pointing to? Maybe. Maybe. It's certainly consistent with it. But it was certainly those three. All right. This is Balaam's thing. All right. Entice them by sexual immorality. So, let's go back to Revelation. I'm going to read the letter to Pergamum again. This is Revelation chapter 2, verse 12. And to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, the words of him who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. Yet you hold fast my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. As discussed last time, this is talking about, this is a very big center of cultic worship. Not only Greco-Roman general cultic worship, but also emperor worship in Asia Minor. But I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel so that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice sexual immorality. So also some of you who hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Therefore, repent. If not, I will come to you soon in war against them with the sword of my mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone with a new name written on the stone that no one knows except the one who receives it. All right. Did he go to the manna here? And we discussed this last time because of the Numbers reference, right? Because this would have been the Israelites in the wilderness. Maybe. Certainly fits. But he's talking to the church, and they're having this problem. And think about them. They're in the middle of persecution, all right? You're in a place where pagan worship is rampant, and a Roman comes to you and says, swear to the genius of Caesar, all right? Burn a little incense. Say, yes, Caesar is divine, all right? The spirit of Caesar is divine. That's all you got to say, and you won't die, all right? We won't arrest you. No, that's all you got to do. Because the Romans didn't care if somebody worshiped Jesus. They did not care, right? What they did care about is if you didn't do the rest. And so that's all you'd have to do. Well, it's no big deal. I mean, it's just, I'll still keep worshiping Jesus, and so I can just do this thing, and okay, they want me to participate in this idol feast, whatever. It's totally fine. I will still be faithful after this point, right? I'll just do this. It'll be fine. And what Jesus is saying to them is, no. Just by doing this, by giving in to, yes, I will swear by the genius of Caesar, or by going into their idol feast to avoid persecution, all right? And in many of these feasts, there absolutely would be sexual immorality, cult prostitutes, things like that. What he's saying is, no, that's too far. You cannot do that. Now, I don't think this is in contradiction to Paul. Paul realizes that just plain food sacrificed to idols, it's just food. But he's very clear on, now, if you're amongst a bunch of people and you hear that this was food sacrificed to idols, what are you supposed to do? You abstain. That's very clear. And what is his feeling about sexual immorality? Paul's the same way. He's like, no, that's wrong, right? You cannot, as he often says to the Corinthians, in the same letters where he talks so much about eating food sacrificed to idols, right? Do not join yourself to the prostitute. This would have been a temptation for everybody in Greece and Asia Minor. That's how their culture worked. And John is telling them in Revelation, I know it's maybe it seems like just to survive. It's not a light fib. It's not a small problem. It's a major problem. All right? You are not allowed to compromise on this. Because God is going to come and make war. I don't think we have time to talk about the church at Thyatira. It might be worth for you for next time. We won't spend as much time, I don't think, on this story as we did on Balaam. But it would be good for you to look up Jezebel. All right? Jezebel, if you look, you'll find in Revelation chapter 2, verse 20, that I have this against you, that you tolerate the woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess and is speaking, and is teaching and seducing my servants to practice sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols, similar to Pergamum. All right? You will find some references there in your notes if you have a Bible with notes to Jezebel, and if you don't, look in 1 Kings and 2 Kings. You will find Jezebel there. All right? Jezebel is one of the bad women of the Old Testament. Very, very bad women of the Old Testament. So go read that, because that's meant to be background to this section of Revelation. Okay. So also in preparation for next time, read, of course, the letter to Thyatira and Sardis and Philadelphia and Laodicea in the next chapter. I don't think we'll get all through all of that next week, but we'll see. Any items of discussion before we dismiss? Okay. Remember, all right, very important lesson. God has a plan for sex. It is within the bounds of marriage. Anything else is idolatry. Okay? It's not just a physical thing. It is idolatry. You will not worship God. Okay? When you do this, you are turning away from Him. Okay? Find the right way. If you're going to get married, find the right one. All right? And that's how you do it. It's the right way to do it. All right? Okay. Mark, will you pray for us, please?